Well, folks, welcome to this last installment, the last and final installment in this course. Today I want to look at the integral equation approach. In some respects, you're losing a bit of relevance, perhaps, but it was a classic method for sure. It was the method that got used the most in the early days of 3D numerical modeling for EM methods. On that basis, I think I should be talking about it here. Also, it's not exactly completely irrelevant by any means. Arguably, it's now got sort of more of a niche market. To contrast the integral equation with the finite difference and finite element methods, and I'll talk a little bit more about this. The integral equation is very much suited to the kind of Earth model where nice sort of simple region that you know everything about, but then there's one fairly localized, interesting, anomalous lump that you want to model the effects of. Whereas for the finite difference and finite element methods, it's very much thinking of, okay, it's the whole domain, it's the whole region of our Earth that we're interested in, that we want to model, that we can perhaps have some variable connectivity throughout that domain. The integral equation is targeted, is good for a slightly different style of models from finite difference and finite element. However, that style of model is not irrelevant these days. You may be more, say, in a mineral exploration kind of or mineral delineation kind of a context where you're looking for an ore body. Perhaps you kind of know where it is, but you're doing some surface and perhaps borehole EM to try and figure out how big it is and how far it extends. Maybe that's kind of the niche market for integral equation methods these days. So not completely irrelevant by any means. Also, it is a classic, so I want to talk about it. It was the first one that got used because it generates fairly small systems of equations, certainly in contrast to the systems of equations you get for finite difference and finite element methods. I mean, the system of equations is dense, it's full, unlike the very sparse ones for finite element and for finite difference. But it was because of those small systems that were actually tractable on computer technology, you know, one or two or three decades ago. That's exactly why integral equation methods were the first ones to be used seriously for 3D modeling. So that was a little bit about the setup and the fact that it's kind of the classic method. Again, just like everything else so far in this course, I'm going to rely heavily on the 1D example. Some of the things, certainly the higher level business of sort of deriving an integral equation and how the integral equation relates to differential equation, the 1D situation is good for that. We can actually do it explicitly for 1D, and the things that we have to do to get our integral equation in 1D are exactly the same things that we have to do to get our integral equation in 3D. However, when it comes to actually do the numerics for that 1D situation, then it's starting to get a little bit specialized. I'll kind of cover that at the end just for completeness, but the numerics for this 1D integral equation problem are not really applicable to 3D integral equation approach, unlike the case for finite difference and finite element. So I'm kind of going to speed up a bit through the end of this talk, but I'll try and include a fair amount just sort of for completeness, but still relying heavily on the 1D situation. So, you know, back to this differential equation kind of encapsulates everything we need to know for the 1D electromagnetic induction situation, and then homogeneous differential equation, but having boundary conditions at the top and bottom, that's how we're going to get our magnetotelluric problem happening here, with some plane wave up at the top and then fields going to zero down at the bottom of our domain. So this is our defining differential equation. The first thing I really want to do is just, starting from here, and a particular Earth model, just move towards what the integral equation actually is. So pretty much the first half of this class is not at all to do with numerics. It's just simply getting an integral equation from the differential equation just to kind of give some basis for it. So in 1D, this is the kind of model that the integral equation method is particularly good at, where, and so this is now side on the standard kind of much better way of looking at 1D Earth, where Earth surface and then this sigma b both above here and below here, that represents some 1D conductivity structure that we can easily calculate the electric fields in, for example. Typically that'll be like a homogeneous half space. It's pretty easy to calculate the 1D fields in a homogeneous half space, or maybe a layered Earth, but certainly at the moment just a homogeneous half space. And then we've got some fairly localized, limited domain, and this is 1D, so we're really looking only with, as a function of Z, we've got a limited range over which the connectivity is doing something different from just the background. And this is what makes it interesting. But this anomalous connectivity that we call it, the difference between the actual connectivity here and the background, it's localized in some certain specific depth range. In 3D, that would be localized in some three-dimensional lump. And so when you have a localization of your anomalous connectivity, then that's screaming out, oh, use the integral equation approach. So if we now go back to the differential equation for our electric field, total electric field at the moment, and if we now start thinking of, okay, the connectivity is a function of Z in here, if we now explicitly start thinking of it in terms of a background connectivity and some anomalous connectivity, whatever those may be, then this is what our integral equation becomes. I mentioned that before, typically homogeneous half space. The background connectivity, in terms of the integral equation approach, the whole point of introducing this is that that thing is going to be a nice simple Earth model, and simple in the sense that, yeah, we can calculate the electric fields in it fairly easily. And so that means this equation, which has just sigma b in here, so this is the equation for what I'm calling the background electric field, this is something that we can do no problem at all. If we have problems getting our background electric field, then we've chosen our wrong background connectivity. So the whole point is that this background electric field in just this background connectivity is something that we can do straightforwardly, easily. So that's the differential equation for the background field, specifically background connectivity. We're going to use that in a moment. And if we now start thinking of the electric field that we need to calculate as being this background electric field plus another bit, and this other bit, the secondary electric field, exists because the connectivity down the ground is not just sigma b, it has this anomalous region in there. So this is kind of the extra bit, the secondary field, the scattered field. That's the difference between background and total. So if we now explicitly take this representation and substitute it into our equation for the total electric field with our total connectivity in here, so that's our total electric field, total connectivity, total electric field, then this is our differential equation. If we now start separating and moving things around, and if we expand out pretty much everything here, so expand out these two terms, sigma b times eb, sigma b times es, but let's keep delta sigma times this floating around here, so pretty much almost expanding out everything that we have, then we're going to take a step back, and we can say that, oh, well, but I know that the background electric field satisfies this equation equals zero, so specifically, that term plus that term is going to be zero, because that's what the background field does for us. So those terms can drop out. And that ends up giving us, and so just pulling this term over to the right-hand side, that gives us this differential equation. It's now in our secondary electric field. And ultimately, the secondary electric field is a thing that we need to find in order to add to our background field to give us our total field, because we know what our background field is. So we got this differential equation now, secondary electric field over there on the left-hand side. We now have this right-hand side term. It involves the total electric field, and it involves the delta sigma, so the anomalous connectivity. Oops, excuse me, so that's it. The two important things about this is that on the left-hand side, so the differential operator, if you want to think of it in those terms, it just has the sigma b floating in here. So that's kind of nice, because we did know that, we specified up front that if all we have is our background connectivity, then, hey, we know how to calculate the electric fields in there. So our secondary electric field just satisfies the differential operator with just sigma b in there. Okay, that's kind of good. We should be able to do that. And then this stuff on the right-hand side, that's really just a source term. Just a source term. Okay, ES is appearing over here, is over there. But at the moment, let's just call this a source term. So it's looking very much as if this is just, hey, it's an inhomogeneous differential equation for a scattered electric field, secondary electric field, and it's a differential operator that we know everything about. So that's probably these two points here that I was trying to make. Differential operator is one that we know everything about. This source term on the right-hand side, it's kind of like extra excessive current that exists in the Earth because of our anomalous connectivity, because it's really conductivity times an electric field, Ohm's law, that gives us our current density. So it's looking as if, you know, you can think of this term on the right-hand side as being an extra anomalous current density down there. And it's that current density that's giving rise to our secondary electric field, and it's to do with this anomalous conductivity, if you want to try and attribute some sort of physical meaning to this source term. But hey, we're now in a situation that to calculate our secondary field, we've got just this inhomogeneous differential equation we need to solve. And it's a differential equation we know everything about. So, kind of standard technique for doing your inhomogeneous differential equations is Green's functions. So let's go about trying to do a sort of solution to this inhomogeneous differential equation. So we need to know a Green's function. So a big G function of both z and z prime. It's going to satisfy the same differential operator that we're concerned with, which is just the one for sigma b. And to make it a Green's function, we've got the Dirac delta function on the right-hand side with the difference between z and z prime. That's just the definition of our Green's function. I'm actually going to go through the steps to show you how this gives us our solution. And so really, this is just a name at the moment. This is the defining equation for the Green's function. Just quick notes about the delta function. Probably all remember this for sure. The delta function is zero if the argument is non-zero, so if z is not equal to z prime. And if we were to take some function of z, multiply it by delta of z minus z prime, integrate with respect to z over some interval that actually includes z prime, then this integral will actually pull out the value of f at z prime. So that's the definition of delta function, and just trying to keep track of primed and unprimed variables here. Okay, so that's the definition of Green's function. And yeah, that Green's function is going to end up appearing in our integral equation. So if one ever wants to do a numerical implementation of an integral equation solution, then yeah, you need to get your Green's functions. You need to be able to calculate your Green's functions. Just mention that in passing. Okay, so the tactic now is if we take our differential equation for the secondary electric field and multiply it by the Green's function all the way through, so that's what we've done here. And then if we take the defining differential equation for our Green's function, so that bit and this bit, and multiply through now by the secondary electric field all the way through, that gives us our two equations. And let's just take the difference between those two. Nothing drops out at this stage. Oops, no, sorry, yes, these terms drop out at this stage from the simple difference just because, you know, this product can be flipped around perfectly well. So these two terms drop out. We've still got the difference between these two terms on the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, we've got the difference between these two terms, which is delta sigma on the Green's function times total electric field, and then a delta function floating around. And so this is all trying to head towards the integral equation that is going to be ultimately a starting point for a numerical method. So what we then do next is take that equation, integrate now over the whole domain, so z going from, you know, minus infinity to plus infinity. That's my situation at the moment for this 1D MT problem. And so these couple of terms on the left-hand side involving second derivatives, then the stuff on the right-hand side, Green's function, delta sigma, and then a delta function in here. Okay, nice mess. If we now look at this thing, this stuff on the left-hand side is now going to disappear. This is going to resemble a bit the machinations I did for the finite element method. However, now at this stage, we're most definitely in the proper, the correct mathematical domain. We're not in the numerical domain. So everything that happens here is going to be fine and good. But if we take, say, one of these terms, so g and then the second order derivative, and let's just do an integration by parts on it over the whole domain. So integration by parts gives us a sort of a boundary term, gives us an integral where now we've got a single derivative on either of these two terms. And now because we're dealing with proper electric fields, proper Green's functions over this infinite domain, then I was probably lazy and didn't explicitly say what the boundary conditions on the Green's function are, but for sure we're in a sort of physical, sensible situation. So everything as we go to plus or minus infinity is going to vanish. Green's functions or electric fields or derivatives. for sure. So that term,
for sure.
Arguably not for one DMT problem. I'll ignore that. So this term is going to vanish for sure, integration by parts, stuff going to zero to infinity. So this integral is going to look like this integral where we've managed to get from a second order down to separating out the first order derivatives. So that's just a repetition of what I said. We can repeat the integration by parts to get rid of this derivative and flip it onto this one. And then again, the surface term, the boundary term, is going to vanish. So that would give us this expression. But, and I should have repeated, if I go back one slide, you know, this stuff on the left-hand side, it's got g times second derivative of secondary electric field, but also secondary electric field, second derivative g, and the difference between these two terms. And by the integration of parts, I'm managing to flip this term into that term, and then the difference between the two will make it vanish. So that's how the left-hand side stuff vanishes out of that integral equation to leave just this thing. And so we've got integral over the whole domain. Put a delta sigma in here, Green's function, total electric field. And then we've got the integral, secondary field, and this delta function still floating around here. And so the next stage is, if we look at what that delta function is going to do to us, do for us, it's just going to pull out the value of the secondary electric field at, you know, wherever that the argument of that delta function is going to be zero, which with the notation I'm using is z prime. So this then ends up being the equation after, you know, we took the equation for electric field, the equation for the Green's function, multiplied one by the Green's function, one by his electric field, subtracted and integrated, and did all that, and this is what comes out at the end. And just simply rearranging to get this secondary electric field on the left-hand side. So we've now got an expression that says secondary electric field at some particular depth coordinate, z-coordinate, is just equal to, you know, constant times the integral over the whole of the z-line of our delta sigma, of our Green's function, and our total electric field. So that there is the integral equation for the secondary electric field. And again, you know, nothing numerical has happened at all yet. This is all proper and correct. One quick sleight of hand just before we do anything else. Normally, but this is not critical by any means, normally people just add the background electric field to both sides because the thing on the left-hand side can then be, you know, then becomes the total electric field. So that's just moving around. So arguably, this is the more common form of the electric field integral equation that gets thrown around. So total electric field at some point is equal to the background electric field at that point plus this integration over the whole real line, the whole Z line, of anomalous connectivity times Green's function times the electric field. And of course, it's this Green's function that depends on both Z, which is now my the variable over which I'm integrating, and Z prime is the variable at which this integral ends up giving me a value at. So integral equation. This thing Z prime, or rather this integral equation, is valid for whether Z prime, you know, is in a region of non-zero delta sigma or whether it's outside a region of non-zero delta sigma. So this integral equation is valid no matter what value of Z prime that is. So after all that, huffing and puffing, this is now the starting point for the numerics for the integral equation method. Let's see, for the finite difference method, and essentially the finite element method, you know, the starting point was the electric field differential equation. For the finite difference method, we just took that and from intuition just introduced finite difference approximations for the derivatives, and away we go. Finite element method still started with a differential equation, introduced an explicit approximate electric field, and then asked that approximate differential equation be satisfied in an average kind of a sense in certain situations. But I mean, both those methods started, the starting point was the differential equation. For the integral equation methods, this here is the starting point for the numerics. Everything I showed you so far involving the differential equations was really just deriving this integral equation. So this is the starting point for the numerical integral equation approach. And now it's very similar to the previous method. Certainly the certainly the way I describe the finite element method and essentially how what's happening with the finite difference method. Here, going to explicitly introduce an approximate electric field that's a linear combination of basis functions. I mean, in principle, these could be over the whole domain, but in practice, any particular basis function is going to be non-zero in one cell or a couple of cells, so very local. So we introduce our approximate electric field. It's going to ultimately involve, say, n numbers, n coefficients. So we just substitute in for our total electric field on the left-hand side of our integral equation. And at the moment, thinking of some specific point, we've got our background electric field. And then on the right-hand side of that integral equation, it was in here, buried deep within the integral, that our total electric field is also reappearing. So we have to stick our approximation into here as well, which is buried within this integration over z. We can move things around a bit, take the summation and the coefficients outside of this integral, and at least sort of tidy up the notation a bit, although sweep things under the carpet. So this is just taking the summation outside and the coefficients outside just to get this integral in here, which it now has a basis function in it, stuff in curly brackets, that ultimately is a function of z prime. And just to hide things completely, we can just introduce notation so that, let's see, everything in the curly brackets here, which involves this integral over the Green's function, let's just call it big gamma. It's going to be some function of z prime, and it will depend on which particular basis function is actually being integrated in here. But for nice, succinct, deceptive notation. So this is now an approximation for the integral equation. I'm being a bit slack here, just repeating it here properly, perhaps. Say we should have a residual again, just to indicate, emphasize that this is an approximate equation because we've introduced an approximate electric field. And so we've got a summation over n terms for our n basis functions. It's appearing on the left-hand side. It also appears on the right-hand side because we have a basis function buried within this Green's function integral thingy, and then our residual term. So this here is, at the moment, it's just one equation in our n unknowns, the n coefficients in our electric field expansion, approximate electric field expansion. So exactly the same situation that we're in for the finite element method and the finite difference method. The trick now is to, okay, well, we have to go from this single equation in all our unknowns into a system of equations that provides enough information to figure out what all those unknowns are. In the terms of the integral equation method, one can just think of doing it in the same way as for the finite element method, or the way I talked about for the finite element method, which is this method of weighted residuals. So we're going to, certainly in general, so we take that equation, think of some weight functions, whatever they may be at the moment, and just take our approximate integral equation, multiply through by the weight function, both left-hand side, the background field term, and then the Green's function integral term. So we're just multiplying through by our weight function, also the residual. Let's do an inner product, which in this case, integral over the whole of the real z line. And then just say, OK, we're going to choose our solution, or we're going to choose a way of coming up with our solution by saying that, OK, we want our residual to be orthogonal to all the weight functions. That then makes this term vanish out of this system of equations because we're going to consider a whole number of weight functions, j. And so that there is going to give us our system of equations, which we can ultimately hopefully solve for our electric fields, these unknown coefficients in the approximate electric field expansion. Kind of just moving things around again so I can write it simply in terms of a matrix equation. So let's just take this term over to the left-hand side, because this is where one basis function shows up. The basis function also appears buried in this integral of the Green's function. So let's just gather those together. I've stuck them over on the left-hand side. They all involve the coefficient of the electric field. Then I've got the right-hand side, which is inner product of my particular weighting function with the background electric field. So this is just moving stuff around so I can then write it in matrix equation notation, where matrix vector of unknown coefficients that I want to find equals right-hand side. And let's see, the various terms are down here, sort of for completeness. That right-hand side, it was the inner product of weight function with background electric field. Let's see the stuff in this K matrix. That was the inner product of weight function with basis function simply. And then it's this matrix G, big G, that involves the inner product of weight function with this strange uppercase gamma term, where this uppercase gamma is the kind of nasty one that involves integral over everything of delta sigma, the Green's function, and my basis function. So at one level, this is exactly how you can go. I mean, once we know what our basis functions are, once we know what our weight functions are, then hey, we can in principle do these and actually come up with numerical values for them, populate our matrices, and solve it, hopefully. Right, yeah, there's this gamma. Nice notation, but it hides a lot. In terms of how the integral equation was first done, and mostly done for the 3D case, then in terms of the basis functions, it wasn't any of these linear edge element things. It was just simply pulse basis functions. So in other words, oh, and taking a step back, kind of assuming people just assume a cuboidal region of anomalous connectivity, non-zero anomalous connectivity, subdivide that into cuboidal cells, and assume that the anomalous connectivity was constant, was uniform in each of those single cells. And then in terms of discretizing the electric field, we would just assume that the electric field is constant within each individual cell. So the unknown coefficients and the expansion for the approximate electric field end up just being the electric field in each cell. So that was pulse basis functions, assuming a constant electric field in each cell. And then in terms of the weight functions, people didn't really think of it as method of weighted residuals, except for Jerry Holman and his chapter in the SEG book, EM Methods in Applied Geophysics, which I like a lot. The original way people did it was equivalent to taking as your weight functions, actually delta functions that were centered at each cell in turn. And what this meant that the system of equations ended up corresponding to requiring that the approximate integral equation be satisfied at the center of each cell in your anomalous region. So that was these delta weight functions. That's kind of known as collocation. If you make those choices, this is a bit for completeness, these integrals that I had a couple of slides back, the general case for the right-hand side and the elements of your matrices, they end up reducing quite a lot, so that the elements in the vector on the right-hand side of your system ends up just being the background electric field at the center of the cells. This particular part of that matrix ended up just being a Kronecker delta, effectively. And then the other part of the matrix floating around on the left-hand side ended up, through all this, simply just being the integral of the Green's function over one particular cell, the cell in which delta sigma was non-zero. You know, so the sort of more obscure integrals reduced to things that were pretty manageable when you had made this assumption of pulse basis functions and this collocation method where your weighting functions are delta functions. So that was the main way that people did things back in the early days of the integral equation approach. The next couple of slides, kind of for completeness, everything so far, yeah, it's been the 1D situation that I've been looking at. You know, explicitly writing down the ordinary differential equations for the electric fields of a function of z. And all that is good because exactly those steps are exactly the same steps that you use in 2D or 3D to set up your integral equation. And also, if you then go ahead and do your discretizations to come up with your numerical approximation. The next couple of steps, where I just sort of look at, okay, what is the background electric field for this 1D case? What is the Green's function for this 1D case? The steps here are getting essentially pretty specialized for just a simple 1D case. The way you go about calculating these things is not really transferable to the 3D situation. Maybe for the electric field, but so the next few slides are kind of for completeness and the sort of the relevance, the usefulness of the 1D example kind of starts to fizzle off a little bit. Okay, so this would be, for the 1D case, this would be the typical background model, so just a homogeneous half space. and let's say we have this is this is the height at which we're saying we've got an H field equal to 1. So a boundary condition equal to the same as the boundary condition I used in the 1D finite difference case. So this would be the background model, nice and simple. This is the differential equation for that background model. Up in the air, down in the ground, uniform connectivity. So in those two regions, sigma is constant. So for this kind of differential equation with a constant coefficient, we know what the solution is going to be. It's going to be of the form e to the plus or minus kz, where k squared can be the negative of that coefficient. So this is the solution to that equation when we're in regions of uniform connectivity. The two boundary conditions are, let's say, up at z equals minus z up here. Same mistake as class one. Let's just say that the H field is equal to 1. Way down at depth, we're getting so far down there that our background electric field is going to 0. And then at the earth-air interface, we want both our background electric field, but also our H field, and hence the z derivative of E field, to be continuous across z equals 0. Let's see, we've got two unknowns here for the background electric field up in the air. We would have two more unknowns down in the ground. So these four boundary interface conditions gives us enough information to figure out what these coefficients would be in the 1D case. Fairly straightforward. For the Green's function, just to do it, one thing that most people did was in the 3D case, or even 2D case, is they kind of assume that their region of anomalous connectivity is far enough below the surface. And if you look at those integrals involved with the Green's function in the cells, they're really involved with differences between the separations from one cell to the next. So it's kind of looking at the effect of one cell on other cells in that anomalous region. So you're only really needing to know the Green's function over distances and for depth ranges corresponding to that anomalous region. Tends to be deep enough that the consequence of having a homogeneous half space can be neglected, and you can get away with using a whole space Green's function. So I'm going to do that here where, you know, for this 1D case, I'm assuming the Green's function should be for the homogeneous half space the same as for the background field, but I'm just going to go for a whole space that has connectivity everywhere equal to the background value. There's going to be some interesting depth, z equal to z prime, which would correspond to where the delta function source for my Green's function is. But first off, okay, so this is defining an equation for the Green's function, delta function centered at z prime. Certainly everywhere that z is not equal to z prime, this is equal to 0. So now I've got a homogeneous equation. This coefficient is constant everywhere. So again, I know that my Green's function is going to be of the form either the plus or minus kz, where k squared is equal to minus that thing. And I also know that as I go way up there, the Green's function is going to go to 0 as I go way down to positive z, positive infinity, the Green's function is going to 0, so that means below z prime. No, sorry, for z greater than z prime, I've got a decaying exponential with depth. Up here, I've got an exponential that decays in the negative z direction. So right there, using the boundary conditions at plus or minus z, plus or minus infinity, rather, I know what my Green's function is going to look like. Again, I've got still got two coefficients I need to figure out, but I've got conditions at z equal to z prime. So far, I've ignored what's happening at z equal to z prime. If I look at what I need to have happen here, I need to have the Green's function be continuous at that point, and I also need to have it so that it is its derivative, g by dz, is discontinuous by an amount equal to 1 at z equal to z prime. If you're interested, I can talk more about that, but that's just, you have to do something similar in 3D, but this is how one does it in 1D, and it's particularly related to just 1D. So again, there's enough information here to figure out what your coefficients are and hence what your expression for the Green's function is for the 1D problem. Okay, in principle, an exercise, but I must admit, when I got to this stage, partly through laziness, but partly just because this 1D example. I mean, for the finite difference and finite element, actually doing the 1D example is very beneficial because it's exactly the same stuff that one does in 2D or 3D. Whereas now, the 1D integral equation, it's getting a bit specialized with that background electric field and that Green's function. So in terms of an example that tries to set up what people are really doing in 2 and 3D, it's not so good. So I'm half-hearted with this exercise, I must admit. Okay, couple of comments on 3D. So the integral equation method found a lot of use in the early days, pulse basis functions and collocation. However, it became pretty obvious, it was pretty well recognized that the formulations that people were using failed once you had a contrast between your anomalous region in the background of, say, hand wavy, like 300 to 1. I think Gregory Newman actually stated the figure, I can't remember. Basically, once your contrast got quite large, then it seemed that the integral equation methods just produced the wrong answers. They didn't produce a strong enough effect. And this kind of goes all the way back to class 2, where I was saying that, you know, any of these numerical methods are introducing, you know, an approximate electric field. There's no way that approximate electric field can satisfy all the rules and regulations that true electric fields satisfy. And something's got to give. Something, you know, one of these rules and regulations, a number of those rules and regulations end up being violated. And, you know, the important thing really then becomes trying not to violate the important ones. And so it was pretty much thought, although it wasn't always clear, that you know, important physics was dropping out of that particular implementation, in particular the physics of, you know, because for large contrasts, you're very much in a conductive lump in a background that's heading towards being a complete resistor. So that's very much the inductive setup, where if you have your transmitter loop over here and you've got your time-varying magnetic field, it's that linkage in the magnetic field from transmitter to conductive lump that then causes current loops to be induced in your lump, which then give rise to secondary fields. You know, it's not current being pumped through, sloshing through the background, because the background's getting so resistive that there is no current flowing from transmitter to conductive lump. So you need very much that inductive kind of physics to be still in your numerical implementation. And what it seemed like was that numerical implementation that people were using, pulse basis functions, so a constant electric field in each particular cell, that somehow that was losing the inductive physics, or rather, the galvanic physics was still in there, but because it was, you've now got this conductive lump in a very resistive background, then the galvanic physics is not what you need, but numerically it was dominating what was going on. And it kind of should have canceled and dropped out, but it never did. You know, so there's been a couple of ways to sort of try and get around that. Gregory Newman, Sanfilippo, and Jerry Holman, in a couple of papers, instead of just having constant electric field in each cell, they actually explicitly introduced basis functions that corresponded to just big current loops that existed through the whole of their anomalous lump, whether it was this way or that way. They would just stick those extra basis functions, which is what they were, into the solution, and that certainly helped quite a bit. I actually worked on this a little bit. I think I got something that works. And I needed to, rather than just having the electric field in one cell be completely separate from the electric field in the neighboring cell, I find I needed to basically tell the electric field that, you know, if these two cells have a nice large conductivity, both have large conductivity but are sitting in a background that's resistive, to nevertheless allow for a big, huge current flow between those two cells. So kind of equivalent, slightly different ways of doing it. And so, yeah, it kind of illustrates a number of issues that are floating around for numerical methods for EMG physics, is that, okay, in 3D, things get a bit complicated just keeping track of the three dimensions and just the extra indices in your three dimensions, so the bookkeeping gets difficult, which is, you know, not insignificant by any means. But also, you know, there is this business of the, you know, the physics that's going on. In some ways, it's pretty straightforward, but in other ways, is not trivial, and that there's this sweep, this range, the spectrum of behaviors going from completely galvanic to completely inductive, that makes it fairly complicated. And especially doing the numerics and introducing your basis functions, doing weighting functions if you're doing that, and coming up with your system of equations, that it's important that by the time you get to your system of equations, you haven't done something that's thrown away the mathematical description of the really important physics that you need still to be in there. So, you know, even that issue, I think, is not completely crystal clear and done and dusted in terms of 3D EM numerical modeling. And not just integral equations, but also finite element and finite difference. Okay, the last slide forever. In terms of integral equation method, it is completely suited to Earth models where you have a localized region of anomalous connectivity. Finite difference, finite element methods are suited to when you're discretizing the whole domain. The connectivity might vary throughout your whole domain to the boundaries. That's not the case for integral equation. It's very sort of specialized in that respect. The good things are you end up with a small system of equations just because you only need a small number of cells, relatively speaking, for a small anomalous region. So it's a small system, quicker to solve, less memory requirements. It's a dense matrix, so it can still get big in a hurry if you start introducing quite a number of cells. And essentially, there's sort of, this is the complete contrast to the finite difference method with the finite element somewhere in the middle. You know, there's quite a lot of analysis that goes on in setting up, you know, first off, the integral equation, which is the starting point of the numerics, but also, you know, the integral, especially that integral that involves the delta sigma, the Green's function, and your basis function. And you need to evaluate that in order to set up your system of equations. So there's quite a bit of analysis flapping around before you're even at the point of working with a system of equations, which is in complete contrast to the finite difference, where we could almost write down the matrix equation just by intuition and staring at the problem. So comparison and contrast. Okay, that's it for today's class. For sure, any questions on this? Happy to take any questions on the rest of the classes as well, any of the exercises, and both right now or in 5 minutes' time after I finish my coffee. We can see. Okay. That's who's come across the integral equation method in the reading, or is it so old-fashioned that see, like it? A few special people, yeah. I mean, it's nobody really. Well, watch what I'm saying. There's certainly a couple of approximations that people are still using that are based on the integral equation method. Personally, I don't think they're particularly good because I think the numerical solution of the integral equation on which they base things is flawed. There are a few integral equation codes floating around, but mostly, you know, since the last 5, 10 years, 15 years, people have been moving towards finite difference codes. And maybe more towards finite element, especially in crustal lithospheric studies, where you are looking at a fairly large region, and you don't really know where within that region the interesting connectivity is happening, and so you want to make sure you can discretize a big enough region that the interesting geology is in there somewhere. You know, rather than having, say, an ore body that's tight and compact, and you know where it is. So, but it was the method. I mean, it was. Let's see. Yeah, I can say. Yeah, it was before my time, even. But at least I was kind of aware of the issues for a while. I guess I've been around long enough that you know, some of those discussions and the ideas about, oh yeah, integral equation failing for contrasts of 300 to 1 or whatever. Yeah, I was around when those concerns were bouncing around. But
yeah. Colin, you may have mentioned this specifically while you were talking about is the method appropriate for a resistor in a conductive host?
Just quickly to repeat the question is just whether this is appropriate for a resistive anomalous region within a conductive host. And yeah, for sure. Certainly in principle, let's see if I can quickly find an equation without, the delta sigma is already buried in here, but it doesn't matter. In principle, it doesn't matter whether that's a region that's more conductive than the background or less conductive. It doesn't matter at all. Most people's thinking has probably been biased towards thinking of this as being more conductive than the surrounding But I think that's purely because of application, just because a large proportion of the application of EM methods is towards finding a mineralized object in a fairly resistive shield kind of background. And so the application tends to be a good conductor in a pretty poor conductor. And that's why, I mean, that's why it became pretty apparent pretty quickly that the implementations that people were using failed for large contrasts was because people were taking the codes and going and using them in a situation where, yeah, they've got a survey, controlled source survey, over an ore deposit that's 1 centimeter per meter or thereabouts in a Canadian shield kind of background of 10 to the plus 4 ohmmeters or something. So people right away took it and tried to use it in situations where it's a large contrast and wasn't giving answers anywhere close to what they'd got by actually flying across it or doing the survey. So in principle, should work okay, I think, yeah. But just the most common application for it was having a more conductive lump in a resistive background.
But there's no secondary field associated with that resistance.
Yes.
What is going on physically?
So in terms of having the conductive lump, then there is a physics of getting the currents in there. This is more for benefit of people without them. Well, since I've only got the microphone, people viewing. In terms of the more resistive situation, arguably that's heading towards, thinking off the top of my head, that's thinking more of sort of, yeah, very much a galvanic situation, perhaps where you've got current, lots of current flowing in the background, and you've got a more resistive lump, and okay, it's varying with time, but really that current's just going to try and evade that more resistive lump. And so definitely, probably, really just galvanic physics, current flow kind of physics, perhaps. I can't think of any results off the top of my head of people specifically looking at that scenario, but just sort of speculating here, that's the physics of what would be going on, I think. At the extreme end, people have used the integral equation approach for modeling DC resistivity, and that works fine. For that scenario, there are not the issues of poor results for large contrasts. So I think it is true that the integral equation approach for the galvanic kind of physics is actually fine. Yeah, it keeps all the appropriate mathematical description of that physics in there, and so I would imagine that the integral equation solution for resistive lump in a conductive background would actually be perfectly okay, perfectly accurate, yes. Can't think of any specific papers or examples where people have looked at that. More questions at the moment?